This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. This is the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Matt Patrick here. Patrick, I'm keeping an eye on my my bracket here. You know, my upset special was going to be Colgate. Unfortunately, they ended up being like a tube of toothpaste, and they didn't do it. But got a big one going right now. Oral Roberts and Ohio State going to overtime.
That Colgate-Arkansas matchup was interesting because it seemed like people either thought that was going to be a 14-3 upset or Arkansas's going to the Final Four. Like, I saw no in-between.
That's the crazy thing. I am still amazed by the amount of people that actually can pick this. They luck into it. I mean, it's pure luck. I've told the story before. Years ago, as a matter of fact, back when I met my wife, the Final Four after I met her. And I'm hanging out with some of her friends, and they say, why don't you fill out a bracket? And I've done a few brackets before. And so I fill out a bracket. I think I missed a total of 6 games. And, of course, everyone looks at you like, whoa, mister, I know college basketball. It's like, okay, I know some a little bit about college basketball. But I don't know a lot about college basketball. I just got lucky.
It's a crapshoot. The people who wing it do just as well as the people who sit down, watch every tournament game, every in-depth report. It all comes out to be a wash.
Yeah, and it really is kind of a joke to a point. I mean, especially anyone who's like, my expert picks. Read this before you fill out your bracket. No, don't. Just go fill. Just don't make the mistake of people who like pick all 16 teams to upset one seed. That's just, you're not going to go anywhere. But, I mean, you know, just take a shot in the dark. I will say this. We better enjoy NCAA basketball because the Gophers aren't going to be good for a while as Marcus Carr now has entered the transfer window. Transfer portal, I believe, is that what the term is they use. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to be a good team. So, Friday Fish Fry, I've got it on good authority. I need to head down to Jordan, Minnesota, so I'm going to head down there. Lindsay's Barbecue Grill, apparently they have a pretty outstanding Friday fish fry down there at Lindsay's, L-I-N-S-E-Y-S, Lindsay's. Lindsay's Barbecue. So I'm heading down to Jordan. Hello, Jordan. I will be dining in, well, I won't be dining. I'll be getting it to go. I'll be, you know, because I'm just, that's how I am right now. So, but I know they have to go, so Friday Fish Fry, and I believe next week is our last week we can. So if you do have a church or an organization that's doing like a pickup drive-through Friday Fish Fry, let us know. You can either call us at 952-946-6205 or just email us at comment@am950radio.com, comment@am950radio.com. I got to get my Friday Fish Fry on. So, you know, let us know about them. And I will head out next week. I'm heading out again. So if you got one, I'll drive a little bit. I can get good authority. It's going to be something delicious. You know, I'll drive out. I have no problem with that. I have no problem with that at all. 952-946-6205. So today I was up. I noticed yesterday I started noticing the pictures from grocery stores from a year ago that people were reposting showing the empty shelves. And I, as a matter of fact, went back and I looked, and indeed, today is 1 year ago I posted these same photos, which I posted again today, of my local grocery store. The area of the paper goods completely gone. The frozen, you know, the frozen freezers pretty much empty. The pasta aisle. The best part about the pasta aisle picture is there's one box of like Cremette mini rings that I guess you would use like in a tuna salad for a church picnic or something like that. That's the only thing. There is no pasta. There is no sauce. Nothing gone. And of course, the other one that I thought was kind of funny was the frozen fruit case, where the only thing left in the frozen fruit case was a package of rhubarb. Yeah, rhubarb, there's plenty of that still available. Everything else is gone. And I remember, and I'll never want to forget this, because I remember at that time, I feeling like, wow, this is pretty spectacular as far as an experience goes. I've not experienced this in my lifetime, actual runs on grocery stores, thinking this was as bad as it was going to get. And I remember it was still kind of one of those things where, sure, Trump was president. Sure, this disease was very serious, but it wasn't going to be that bad, was it? We'll get food back on the shelves. You know, someone will come up with a miracle plan. It's not going to be that bad. And then, boom, it just hit. We thought at the time we took these pictures, we thought sacrifice was having to go without your favorite. Not without food. There are still plenty of food in that store now, and I'll remember that. There are still plenty of food in that store. It just is the favorites, like the frozen pizzas and the huge bags of rice and all the pasta. They were gone. Peanut butter, couldn't find. But there was still plenty of food there. It wasn't like there was ever a chance where you weren't going to have food, or that the federal government was going to have to come on in with National Guard trucks and start distributing. I'll also never forget, I was at a Target, I think. I was looking at the photos, and it was like 3 weeks later when you'd have to get to the Target right away in the morning, right before they opened, and wait in line and go back, and then you could get toilet paper then. But still, that was a minor sacrifice. Because you know what a major sacrifice is? 30 million sick. 500,000 plus dead. That is a sacrifice. That is you not having peanut butter for a few weeks. That's not a sacrifice. And that is what has been driving me crazy. As you have these people that are out there who are screaming about upend everything. What their whole thing is that I don't want to go one week without peanut butter. So if I do, everyone needs to stop and give me peanut butter now. And you selfish, self-centered jackasses. I want my chicken wings and a pitcher of beer, and I want to watch the NCAA tournament. Well, tough noogies, okay? Seriously. But you see, this is why this has been the saddest year. Not because of this, because, I mean, there was, like I said, that was, as a guy who knows how to cook food, I never was really concerned about whether or not I was going to have enough food. But as a person who has always felt at the end of the day, most people had good inside them, I realize there's about 30 to 40% of this country that could care less if you die, a family member dies, a coworker dies. Heck, I don't think they really care if their own family members die, because I want peanut butter and I want it now. That is the age of greed. And I have talked about this for what is near now 11 years of being on this radio station. The age of greed's toll is clear. These people, especially all these people that claim to be Christian, they're not Christian. They're not Christian. They're nowhere near Christian. They're just selfish. And that's sad. At the end of the day, I want everyone to live. I want everyone to be alive. I want everyone healthy. I wouldn't want that to be the case. And to realize that, wow, such a statement is such a controversial one for some people. is mind-blowing, is abso-freaking-lutely mind-blowing. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So I'm going to try to put this together because I got a few things I got to get to here. We are at a point where we need only one more juror for the the trial of former Officer Chauvin. We are needing only one more juror at this point, as there were some rulings today, and I'll run through this here. The Derek Chauvin murder trial staying put and staying on schedule. Now, I said this yesterday. The fact that they were up to, at that point, 12 jurors told me that there was a decent chance they weren't going to move this, because they would move it if they were having a hard time. If they were like six, maybe that was a case where they might be able to say, okay, yeah, we need to move the trial. But that was not the case, and that's not where they ended up going. So those rulings on Friday from Hennepin County District Judge Peter Cahill on defense motions for a change of venue and continuance in the case against the fired Minneapolis police officer accused of causing the death of George Floyd late last spring, with jury selection clear to resume Friday, one more has been chosen. That leaves just one more spot to reach the 12 who will need to deliberate and the two who will serve as alternates. Cahill weighed both significant options for much of this week in the wake of the well-publicized announcement of last week's $27 million settlement against the city of Minneapolis and Floyd's family. It led to the dismissal of two seated jurors who had said it impacted their viewpoint. Unfortunately, the pretrial publicity will continue to no matter how long we continue the trial, so the judge said. And like I said, you move this to any other county, you think there's not going to be pretrial publicity there? However, he acknowledged the impact of the city settlement on the case. I'll be very honest. When I was first brought up by the defense, I thought they were overstating. And he said, I was a little shocked when we called back the 7 of the 9 jurors that had been seated, and 2 of them basically said they could no longer be fair and impartial any longer. Regarding the change of venue, the judge said, I don't think there's any place in the state of Minnesota that has not been subjected to extreme amounts of publicity in this case. With that, we'll continue with jury selection in this case and in this county. Attorney General Keith Ellison, whose office is leading the prosecution of Chauvin, said the court has taken careful, considerate steps to mitigate the effects of pretrial publicity that make a continuance and change of venue unnecessary. A week ahead of schedule, both sides now have agreed on 12 jurors, more than half of whom were selected since early last Friday afternoon, and all of whom have been carefully screened for impartiality in the face of inevitable pretrial publicity, not only in Hennepin County, but in very part of Minnesota. And in other motions, Cahill ruled that only portions of the events surrounding Floyd's drug arrest in Minneapolis on May 19, 2019 are admissible in the trial, namely any evidence or testimony that directly relates to his medical condition after taking a police officer having a police officer point a gun at him and taking him into custody. Not to be admitted from the 2019 arrest, the judge said, is anything about his emotional behavior, such as calling out for his mother, something he did in both encounters. The police said he also will allow during the trial the admission of a portion of the body camera video from the 2019 arresting officer. Floyd's blood pressure results at the scene, a suspected illicit drug pill in his car, and his statements to the paramedics that are for the purpose of her diagnosis. Cause of death is clearly an issue here, Cahill said, noting that the defense and the prosecution are at odds in this area. Here's my problem, and that is, look at what's going on in Atlanta. Clearly, this, and it was interesting, there's a person who is a therapist for sex addicts, and he said, let me make sure I'm very clear about this. Being a sex addict does not mean you want to go and murder people. That is not sex addiction. And you sure as heck would not use that as a defense sex addiction when you specifically targeted women of Asian descent. And so the idea, we all see it. We all see what this guy did. He targeted Asian women. And whether or not there is a manifesto that says, I believe in what Trump is saying, or if it's just the fact that we have to go off on what he has done, he clearly targeted Asian women. The same thing here. I mean, it's okay. George Floyd died because Derek Chauvin, with a smirk on his face, put his knee in the back of his neck and held him down for 9 minutes. And I would like to see the reality of that set in, that the reason he's dead is because Derek Chauvin put his knee and cut off his windpipe and never bothered to check to see if the man was alive. But what I don't like about this judge's ruling is that, okay, well, you know, maybe it was a microscopic meteor that came on down and hit the... Of course they're going to try to say it was something else. Because they've got a 9 minute long video which shows Chauvin murdering George Floyd. And I'm sorry, I don't... You don't have to try to make it easier for them by bringing in outrageousness as a defense. You know, if a guy is hit on the road by a truck, you don't sit there and say, you know what I think really caused his death? Drugs. No, no, it was the truck that hit him. That's what did it to him. If he gets eaten by a shark, you don't look and say, well, see what happens when you do meth? No, you don't do that. The shark was there. So, you know, it's going to be an issue in there. And I really do not like how this ruling basically tries to present, well, you know, It wasn't the knee to the back of the neck. It was the hangnail he had. I don't like that idea. I don't like trying to create arguments. And I know I'm simplifying it, and I know I'm paraphrasing it, but that's exact. We all know what happened here, don't we? In the afternoon, the prosecution used one of its discretionary strikes to dismiss the day's fourth prospective juror. The judge then excused the next possible juror, a woman who revealed some private information with the live stream audio muted and the news media sent out of the courtroom. The defense spent one of its strikes and dismissed a college student who has protested since Floyd's death. Questioning of the final juror candidate has begun. If not chosen, the pursuit of the final juror will resume on Monday. One disclosed that she had heard about the settlement and used her to work in a suburban police department. The other was troubled emotionally by seeing the bystander video and pointed out Floyd's arrest. Opening statements and testimony are due to begin on March 29th. Attorneys both sides questioned the juror about her volunteering and on behalf of the homeless and concern for affordable housing. She said she saw the oft-mentioned bystander video of Floyd's arrest and wrote in her juror questionnaire months ago, this restraint is ultimately responsible for Mr. Floyd's demise. That said, she pledged under defense scrutiny Friday that she could presume Chauvin innocent, as the law requires her to do. The prospective prosecution saw the woman as having a fairly favorable view of police, and she said that if a suspect is not listening to what the officer commands are, obviously something needs to happen. I don't think murder is part of that. She was more critical of the criminal justice system once cases moved into the courtroom, saying you have a better chance of proving your case if you have a private lawyer than if you have a public defender. And there are instances where innocent people are convicted. So 13 people so far. We'll have to wait and see. I'll double check here during the commercial break if we got the 14th one seated or if that's going to move to Monday. AR, hold on. We'll get your call after the break. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. AR is in Plymouth, has been kind enough to hold. Welcome on in, AR.
Hey, Matt, how you doing?
All right, sir.
I just wanted to offer my own two cents, because there's a lot of skepticism and there's a lot of people that just don't flat out believe that this kid's claims about being a sex addict. And, you know, it's entirely possible that he's a sex addict. I'm one. I'm also a pastor's kid. I grew up in the church, you know, kind of like this kid did. I never thought about murdering folks. I mean... And to try to blame it on some sort of an addiction is it's not just a stretch, but it's a cop out. I mean, I think it's more likely this kid's was part of some like radicalized incel group.
You know, there is that too. And AR, thank you very much, and thank you for sharing. I mean, that personal stories are always they you know kind of add a lot of validity, and so thank you, AR. I appreciate that. Okay. If you want to say he's a sex addict, that's fine. We do know this. He targeted Asian women. And we're done here, aren't we? And we're done here. You know, you know, there's other things. I mean, as AR brought up, I mean, there's that incel side that we've had a few shootings in this country where these people that are upset because they haven't been able to date people that they want are you know, will open fire on groups and stuff like that, or kill women. There is that. I've wondered a little bit about if there's something that going on there. You know, a sex addiction he has, well, that's just part of his kind of his, you know, list of problems there. But the primary list here is he opened fire on multiple people, primarily Asian women, in what clearly seems to be attack on Asian women. And so I'm flabbergasted in the Atlanta case that there are so many people that are desperately trying to find a way to not label reality as reality. In the same sense, as it's frustrating to me because we know what killed George Floyd. We do all know that. And so, yeah. This is the latest update on the Chauvin trial. This is from Unicorn Riot, and which, again, if you're not following Unicorn Riot on Twitter, they are sensational. Chauvin's defense has potential juror 111 struck. He won't be on the jury. That means one juror spot still needs to be filled, but there's no more juror scheduled for today, so jury selection will resume on Monday at 9 a.m. Opening arguments are still slated for a week after that on March 29th. Apparently they said they were going to call in juror 113. What it seems like had happened is 113, juror 113 had actually been sent home. So once 111 was gone, they didn't really have anyone else. So they've called court for the day. They are up to, once again, 13. They need one more alternate juror or one more juror. Whether that juror is the alternate remains to be seen. But they need one more juror to get to 14. I think they're going to have it here. But I am terrified of what will happen in this town if people somehow are allowed to believe, after watching that 9-minute video, and they're going to watch that 9-minute video in court. They're going to watch that 9-minute video. They're going to have to, you want to know the truth is, part of me wonders if Chauvin will come to a plea agreement prior to that moment happening. Because I have a very hard time, even if there are people who are, you know, kind of more pro cop on the jury, watching that video, the entire 9 minutes of it, and somehow saying to yourself, well, yeah, like I was mentioning before, he was eaten by a shark, and someone says, well, that's what meth will get you. No, I don't know how you're going to be able to counterpoint that, especially when the prosecutors are going to be arguing quite clearly, no, he died of asphyxiation, knee to the back of the neck. And, you know, you can, you know, your argument is going to have to be in the fantastical. That, you know, that somehow, some way he died of another cause as he was clearly being murdered by a cop. That's going to be, and they're going to have to come out and say, well, clearly this is not how you deal with a suspect here, but gee willikers, golly gosh. I would not be surprised if that case does indeed go to, they plea that out before that video gets played in the courtroom, because I still do think that to a point that is a very difficult thing for them. It's gonna be very difficult for them to get around that. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, we got two guests coming in. Laura Lee Campos. Now, this is the woman. She's a parenting expert. My wife, who works for a company, was at a corporate seminar, and they brought her on in as a speaker. And she brought up a story that I actually wrote about in MinnPost back in 2012 about an incident when I had a kid. We were at the baseball park, and another kid swore at me how I got in trouble because God forbid I allow a 12-year-old to start swearing at me. She actually recited the story, which my wife thought was hilarious. Needless to say, I tracked her down, Laura Lee Campos. She's a parenting expert. We're going to talk with her, get her background, and find out a little bit more about, and maybe get some advice from her in regards to getting back into the real world after coronavirus. And then also, we got coming up here, Brett is going to be chatting with Alan Colon of the Student Loan Justice Center. They're talking about student loan debt forgiveness and actions that can be taken. Because once again, remember, Betsy DeVos, even though that the courts had ruled that a lot of that debt was illegal, Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration's education department prevented a lot of that from ever getting taken care of. As a lot of people have been living under some tough conditions. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. Minnesota coronavirus update when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Am I missing something here? Okay, so I'm wearing a Twins hat, right? The old TC logo. Classic. It is a classic. It's a great logo. Of course, they had that 90s version that came through that was popular, the M that was on the logo. I was never a big fan of that.
I love the M, but that could just be nostalgia because that was the logo when I was a kid.
Well, and I mean, I grew up with Twin Cities, the TC. Well, I'm getting kind of taken to task. They're saying, well, outstate Minnesota is not going to be happy with you. Is outstate Illinois get upset with Cubs hats, Chicago Cubs hats, or, you know, Chicago White Sox, or, you know, is Missouri, outstate Missouri get upset with St. Louis Cardinals? And I understand it's the Minnesota Twins, but yeah, TC. I'll tell you what, if outstate Minnesota pays for the stadium, if they pay for the stadium, I'll put an M hat on in a heartbeat. Okay. You pay for the rest of these stadiums. M all the way. No problem. Yeah, this is who's in debt. this team, the Twin Cities. So I'll stay with the TC because that's where the pain is. 952-946-6205. By the way, also, yes, indeed, there will be some dancing a little bit later on. Oh, joy. Let's get into the Minnesota coronavirus update. Now, once again, one of the things which we have to keep reminding ourselves, because there's just a lot of people out there that want to kind of skip past a lot of this. When numbers start going up, it's not necessarily hospitalizations start going up. That's usually about 2 weeks later. When case counts go up, about 2 weeks later, hospitalizations start going up. And about 3 or 4 weeks after the case counts start going up, then deaths start going up as well. Kind of that's the cycle that things have been going in. Right now, case count in Minnesota is starting to go back up. 1,449 new coronavirus cases, 9 more deaths linked to COVID-19. The Minnesota State Department of Health announced on Friday. The latest numbers mean the 7-day rolling average for net case increases is now about 1,098 per day, according to the Star Tribune's coronavirus tracker, continuing a recent trend of case increases. From late January through early March, 7-day averages generally ranged from 7,500 to 1,000 cases. The statewide tally for people who have received at least one vaccine dose increased by 34,682 in the latest data release, for a total of 1,337,982 people so far. That's about 24% of the state's population, according to the Star Tribune. Health Department says 788,495 people have now completed the two-dose vaccine series. Vaccine figures could understate the total for doses administered due to the reporting delays. Numbers reported Friday were current 2 days ago. Residents on long-term care and assisted living facilities around accounted for about 3 of the 9 newly announced deaths. Since Minnesota started detecting virus infections in March of 2020, the state has reported 502,893 positive cases, 26,578 hospitalizations, and 6,771 deaths. The state's one-day count of 1,449 new cases came on a volume of 40,000 newly completed tests, meaning the share of the tests coming back positive was again below the state's caution level of 5%. The positivity rate, however, has been increasing over the last week or so. The Star Tribune's tracker shows 58% new hospital admissions reported on Friday, compared with 42 admissions reported on Friday of March 12th. Daily announcements of new admissions typically include patients who have entered the hospital at some point over the last 7 days, not just the most recent day. While the number of COVID-19 patients in Minnesota hospital beds continues to be low compared with peaks last year, it's been increasing in recent days. People got to be careful. You got to be careful. And I don't know if this is necessarily how you're being careful. I'm actually fascinated when you talk about those case increases. I am fascinated to find out what the breakdown is of those cases in Carver County. And it was Pine City. I remember where the other outbreak, I believe, was. So it'd be Pine County. I would be interested to see what the breakdown in cases are in those two counties. Because I will tell you this about Carver County. They're going nuts over there. There is a real concern in Carver County right now in regards to coronavirus. And I'm wondering if a large portion of these new numbers are really kind of centric on Carver County. This next decision, like I said, I don't know if this is necessarily going to help things here. Federal health officials have revised their guidance to schools on how far apart students should be spaced in classrooms, now saying desks can be placed 3 feet apart instead of 6 feet apart to limit the spread of COVID-19. The updated guidance from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention comes as schools across the country are facing increasing pressure to fully resume in-person classes after a year of virtual classes. The Biden administration released guidance last month detailing 5 mitigating techniques that should be used to safely conduct in-person learning, including mask wearing, social distancing of at least 6 feet, frequent hand washing, proper cleaning of classroom surfaces and ventilation, and rapid testing. Friday's updated guidance also says elementary schools can safely use a distance of 3 feet between desks and classrooms as long as masks are worn and other safety precautions are taken. Middle and high schools can also rely on reduced distance in classrooms unless they are in an area with a high risk of community transmission of the virus. That seems to match up with what the governor's plan has always been, which is your county, your school district's rate of infection is going to dictate how open you're going to be able to be. 6 feet of distance is still recommended between adults working in schools and between adults and students, as well as in common areas and at times when masks cannot be worn, such as while eating. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC, said the new guidance follows several studies showing the smaller distance requirement could be used safely. Those updated recommendations provide the evidence-based roadmap to help schools reopen safely and remain open. While the CDC has recommended 6 foot distance, other health organizations have suggested a smaller distance would be safe for students. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, which represents 1.7 million pre-K through 12 grade teachers and other school personnel, offered a skeptical statement in response to the new guidelines. While we hope the CDC is right and these new studies convince the community that the most enduring safety standard in this pandemic, the 6 foot rule, can be jettisoned if we all wear a mask, we will reserve judgment until we review them, especially as they apply in districts with high community spread and older buildings with ventilation challenges. Walensky said she has spoken with leaders from teachers unions. They know that we need to follow the science and to make our guidance based on the science, and they've been very respectful of that. Well, it's interesting because we're going to say this and we'll read this and you'll hear this statement from the teachers union. We'll hear comments from Denise Sprecht over at the Education Minnesota, the Minnesota Teachers Union. But there's always people out there. Get back into school and teach. because you know they'll wrap their argument in this guidance of, well, kids need to be around other kids. I'm not going to necessarily disagree with that, but reminder, what they're saying is this: I don't care about the teacher or the staff's health. I just want my kid out of my house during the day, and I want them at school. And that really kind of is the argument. And before you jump on me and say, Matt, how dare you? Let me pull up that little story, that gem of a story that came across from the Minnesota Reformer yesterday. Five school staff members have died of COVID-19 since August, according to the Minnesota Department of Health. The state has reported so far a total of 16,185 COVID cases associated with schools. Just under half of them staff members. So far, 118 staff have been hospitalized. The news that two school staff members have died of COVID-19 in 2 weeks is a tragic reminder this pandemic isn't over. Everyone in our school community, family, students, and educators must remain vigilant. This is Denise Specht over at Education Minnesota. And keep each other safe. More than 500,000 Minnesotans have tested positive. And if you sit there and you say to yourself, well, only five. These are five that have been traced to they picked up the coronavirus in the classroom. So, five school staff members have died by basically going and doing their job. Now, I'm no expert at teaching, but I don't believe when someone gets into the teacher field, there is a really, yeah, hey, by the way, just FYI, let's talk about how you can die. Now, it's usually not a consideration for the teaching field. I mean, it's not like you're working like on an oil rig or astronaut, jet pilot, you know, deep sea diver, mountain climber. I mean, you kind of face up to the fact that there's a decent chance you might not get back at the end of the day when you choose one of those jobs. But teacher is generally not one that you expect to have, you know, the chance of you going back to work and dying because you went back to work. Five people in the state of Minnesota, because they went back to work to try to do the betterment for the community after people demanded the schools reopen, are now dead. 118 had been hospitalized. And by their own numbers here, around 8,000 teachers and staff members of schools have been sickened by this demand that people get back, get in the classroom and teach. I want you to imagine what the people who screamed that would be like if people demanded they get back into a crowded work environment with questionable health protections and the fear that you could be in a room with a whole bunch of asymptomatic kids and you just don't know. Imagine what that person would be like if you told them, well, you are going to have to go to that convention and, you know, I'm not sure what kind of ventilation they're going to have. I know it's going to be packed to the gills at the convention center, and we'll hope we have some safety protocols in place, but we can't really say for sure. It's really kind of hard to put them into place. And yet, I want you to think about how many of those same people would, if you put that on them, the people that have been demanding teachers get back into classrooms, brave teachers, and I commend you. You guys are doing a great job under this unbelievably stressful year. Not only has your job been completely thrown into the air on how you teach kids, but you have arrogant jackasses demanding you guys put your life on the line because, well, they just don't want their kid home anymore. And that's got to be tough. So I'm with you guys. Education Minnesota, I think you guys are doing a great job. Can you imagine if what those people would be like if the demand was on them as opposed to others? This is one of the reasons why when people say, and I'm very glad Tim Walz, Governor Walz, made teachers a priority. This is why when people say, Matt, when are you getting your shot? I'll tell you what, I'll get it after. Remember when we demanded all those grocery store workers and Target employees and Walmart employees and all the delivery drivers? Remember when we demanded they get back to work? Well, they can go get vaccinated before I can because they put themselves on the line. You remember all those quirky little signs? We appreciate the frontline workers. Now it's time for us to show how much we appreciate them by getting them vaccinated. That's the least we can do. Jim is in St. Louis Park. Let's get him in before we go to the break. Welcome on in, Jim.
I know, Matt, you know, several times, you know, people have told me, well, you know, it's mostly older people dying and people dying with pre-existing conditions. And one guy told me that, and I said, so you see it as efficient, effective euthanasia. And he said, I didn't say that. And I said, well, yeah, you did.
Well, yeah, you did. Yeah, no, you did, you know. Do we knock Grandma and Grandpa out before we put them on the Viking ship and put them out burning out in the middle of the lake? Or is that something they can be alive, awake for that, you know, that sort of thing? It is amazing to me the amount of people that can sacrifice another human being.
And if anybody dies, the school system is responsible, and they will hear about it if it's a parent that dies, a grandparent that dies, a teacher that dies. And the other problem schools have is some of the parents want to send their kids to school. Other parents do not. Some teachers are more vulnerable, so they can't teach. Mm-hmm. Other teachers can. You know, so there's all kinds of factors that play into whether schools are open.
Yeah, Jim, thank you very much. And he's absolutely correct. At my kid's school, thank you, Jim. I appreciate the phone call. At my kid's school, there were some of their teachers who did have underlying health problems who were not back, that they were still doing a remote learning model, even though they were back, they started going back in the classroom. And I'm perfectly fine with that. I don't need that teacher to go in there and jeopardize their life. If that's how they're going to get through it, then they get through it. And the good news is the teachers have gotten vaccinated, at least in our school. Most of them have, at least. And so Godspeed there indeed, but... You know, it just stop demanding other people because, like I said, those are real numbers. There are five, we had five teachers die, or five, I should say, teachers or staff members die at schools because of getting coronavirus in the school. Had 118 staff members hospitalized, had 8,000 or so sickened. There are consequences for your demands. For God's sakes, act like it. 952, that you understand that. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break, come on back. One more story in the Minnesota coronavirus update before we get to the top of the hour. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Is Oral Roberts one guy? He's good. If it is one guy who just beat Ohio State, that's pretty good. Loyola Chicago looking like the continuing. They're doing well right now. That's I'm already out. My bracket's already busted. It took me about 20 seconds.
I saw Oregon State is hammering Tennessee, but Tennessee kind of faltered late in the season.
Did they? I have no idea. Okay. I'll take your word. Patrick's smarter on some things than I am. I'm going to take his word on this. I don't have time to. I can barely remember all the 10 teams in the Big Ten, let alone, you know, pay attention to other conferences. Although I do have a friend of mine, an old military friend of mine, Newman, who lives out in Oregon. He's a huge Oregon State fan, so I imagine he's going crazy right now. He's a principal at a school too, so I got to imagine that school is pretty much being unrun right now. 952-946-6205. The Axios has an interesting story. Last one here on the Minnesota coronavirus update. Political divide over the COVID-19 vaccine threatens to hamper efforts to hit herd immunity and return to pre-pandemic life in Minnesota and beyond. Public polling has shown that vaccine hesitancy remains stubbornly high among Republicans, and that can be a problem as wider swaths of the population become eligible for the shot. 50% of Minnesota Republicans say they won't get the vaccine per one KSTP poll. Compared with 28% of the state's compared with 28% of the state's population, 7 in 10 who identify as very conservative are a no. Driving that is the mentality is public health experts. Dr. Fauci says endorsements from GOP leaders could make a difference. Trump followed that advice and recommended his supporters get a vaccine during an interview. But that led to, by the way, and I don't know if you saw this, a wild moment on CNN where they're trying to do the in the diner thing and they basically, these guys in the diner, these conservatives in the diner are like, yeah, I think Trump's wrong on this. I'm turning on him. You know, when the conspiracy theory become, you have the ability for conspiracy theories to become their own thing, that the person saying the conspiracy theory can actually be saying the complete opposite and they still will rather go with the conspiracy theory. That's how you know your party's out of control. In Minnesota, outreach and support from the GOP leaders has been mixed. While some Republican figures have promoted the vaccine, even going as far as helping people find appointments, others, including numerous state legislators and former Viking Matt Burke, have expressed concerns or skepticism. So Matt Burke, he doesn't seem to be pro-vaccine. Scott Jensen, a physician and former state senator running for governor, told in an interview that he recommended the vaccine for older patients, but contrary to public health guidance, he would leave it at your choice for people who are young and healthy. It's going to be interesting to watch all these people say, you remember when I was saying vaccines don't help? He said he won't get the shot right now because he's had COVID-19 despite CDC recommendations to be vaccinated. Anyway, Republican Party Chair Jennifer Carnahan told Tori Van Oot over at Axios, vaccination is a personal choice and that the party has no role in promoting the public health initiative. Great. When asked whether she'll get a shot, Carnahan said she's been too busy with her leadership reelection campaign to consider it, a.k.a. if she gets a shot, that's going to hurt her campaign chances. House GOP leader Kirk Dowd is among those voicing support for COVID-19 vaccines, though he noted the rights of those who don't want to get shot should be protected. I personally have 100% confidence in the vaccine and would encourage anyone to get it. Given the hyper-politicization of the pandemic, continued messages of support from elected Republicans would go a long way in persuading hesitant Republicans, University of Minnesota political scientist Catherine Pearson had said. Get the shot, for goodness sakes! Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, what are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to do? We're back hour two up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, an update on the trial. Now, the Cahill says, the judge says he wants 15 jurors, not 14. So they are still two short, not the one short. But frankly, the way they've been putting jurors on the trial, jurors on the jury, I don't think that that's going to be a big problem come Monday. They should be able to have that finished up completely, I got to believe. Unless something really extraordinary happens. So it's 15 is what his goal is. So he wants two more there. Also, this breaking news, U.S. Army Corps has suspended the wetlands permit for Poly Mitt Coppermine.
I'm shedding no tears for that.
That is not. No, I don't want to necessarily pollute the entire northern tier of Minnesota. I think that would be, I don't know, bad. I think the technical word is bad for that. So that's good news there. Now we just need to stop line three and things will be great. Things will be great.
That among many other things, yes.
Are you going to get out this weekend?
Oh, absolutely. Tomorrow looks great.
Well, both days. 62? I was looking at Sven's weather forecast.
Sunday was going to rain a little bit.
No, that's Monday.
Okay.
Monday, Tuesday. Sunday, 62 sunny. Tomorrow's supposed to be like 59 sunny. Just gorgeous. I'm definitely going to get on out. Do you know who else is getting out right now?
Oh, who's that?
Door-to-door salesman. I've had more door-to-door salesmen, and you know what I think is really going on here? Those stimulus checks. They know people have stimulus check money, and they're coming and knocking. Hey, you want me to go up on your roof and check your shingles? No, I don't. Okay, so we remodeled our house 6 years ago. And we wanted to take it. They had the old original shakes on the wood shakes, and we didn't want to get rid of those. And so we updated the house. I actually had a guy come up last year, and you know, the door to door is like, hey, I'm just going to tell you, whoever did this job, they did a crud job. I'm like, no, they didn't. I'll tell you what. You want me to call them right now, and you can bring up your concerns with them? Oh no, I mean, if you think it's good, I was like, no. Do you want to call them, and I'll challenge you? Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. But no, I think people are trying to get money out of people's pocket, and all of a sudden it's knocking. Hey, how about I go start roaming through your yard on your house and seeing what I can do?
who hires someone to do that? A door-to-door salesman. I would never hire anyone to work on my place from a door-to-door salesperson.
There was a woman who in Eden Prairie just sent $35,000 in like Buffalo Wild Wing gift cards because some guy called her up and said to her, I'm the federal government to clear your name. I got to get me some wings. And she paid them. Repeatedly.
Well, if you're paying someone in B-dubs, you know, that's the way to go. That's legitimate.
Feeling good in the neighborhood. I think it was like Applebee's and Chili's. I'm like, really? You guys, it tells me a lot about the criminal here. You guys need a better diet.
Wait,
you
know? So if you're the criminal and you're asking for these gift cards, I mean, are you really going to all of these places the rest of your life? Or is there a way you can sell these for cash?
Oh, my doctor said I need this. I need a Whole Foods one. You get a Whole Foods gift card or... You know, one of those grainy restaurants, you know, something, you know, lots of health, good fiber. I'll be good there.
Gift cards have an expiration date, like 2025. Oh, hey, your gift card expired. You guys have to pay the $25 for your dinner.
No! Apparently, these gift cards, when they figured out that this woman was being robbed blind, they went and tracked the gift cards. They'd all been used up. All of the... Apparently, they do need their baby back, baby back, baby back. Never mind. No,
I'm sorry. Just picturing this guy on a roof throwing, you know, like you see people throwing out cash. This guy's just throwing out Buffalo Wild Wings gift cards to everyone.
Because that's how I pay my taxes. I mean, this year, I've got them an A&W gift card, a 2-for-1 Frosty, and I got an old OCB 2-for-1 coupon. I'll send that along with them. Thanks for my taxes being paid. I would not. There are certain things I will not do with a door-to-door salesman. Pretty much everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Windows, siding, roof, driveway. No. Maybe if it was my neighbor's kid coming over to say, "Sir, can I mow your lawn?" Maybe.
That's not really a door-to-door salesman, though.
Oh, like if someone... he's doing it right.
Well, I know you did sales a while back. Did you ever do door-to-door sales, or did you never get into that?
My first job as a kid was doing door-to-door sales of coupon books. And God, was that a horrible job. And I had to work in a diner. Hi, here is a coupon book that you can buy. And I'm walking a lot. And of course, they take us out to Wayzata. And it's kind of like McGinty Road 101 there. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the houses are only like an acre away from each other. I'm like, this sucks. I don't like doing this anymore. So, yeah, I did door-to-door sales for a while. But, I mean, that's a coupon book, like a happenings book when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, hey, you got $20,000 in the bank? Let me do some work on your house. I just was roaming on by here. Just thought I could help you out. Actually, I should mention this. There was a great article, and I'm going to dig this up. There are places in the country where these people live that go on out after hailstorms or bad storms or anything, and they go work a community, mm-hmm. and they rip everyone off, and then they go back. And because they give so much money to the local sheriff and the local, the police and the county and everything, they will not arrest them, even if you bring evidence. And they finally got these guys with federal warrants, but then the police went and warned them they were coming, and they all ran. And so, you do get these kind of coordinated groups that come through an area, and they're like, hey, well, I can tell you what, your roof looks like it's ready to collapse. You better let me, a complete and total stranger, start hiking up around there, and I'll take a looky poo around. The worst part was my neighbor actually had the guy on his roof. I'm like,
oh no.
No.
Hope the neighbor didn't end up hiring the guy.
I hope he didn't either. But, you know, maybe he just is like, okay, sure, you want to walk around on my roof? I don't care. But no, be careful out there. Be careful. Check with the Secretary of State's office knows a lot about this stuff. Better Business Bureau knows a lot about this stuff. The Chamber of Commerce will let you know a lot about these things. You can find these customer reviews out there. They're out there. So, wait,
couldn't you do like a reverse scam on them and just have them walk around your roof, keep promising you're going to hire the guy, just keep stringing and leading him along? Obviously, you take a lot of time, but you could just waste their time and say, oh, I really want to hire you, but can you take a look at this first?
I had a guy come to my door back when I got back from the military. I was living over by Bede Makoska, and this guy comes to the door selling Electrolux vacuums and says, I'll come on in and give you a demonstration by vacuuming my floor. And I said to him, okay.
So you did it. All right.
Knock yourself out. Of course, he turns on his vacuum, and like any kind of mid-20-year-old guy's apartment, it just is like he's sucking up about 40 pennies. Hey, you missed a spot over there. I felt so bad after this because that guy was pissed off with me. I felt so bad after that. I vowed I won't ever kind of jerk a guy around like that. But I'm not buying a roof from some guy that just shows at my door.
Well, if they're a clear scammer like that, I don't think there's any problem leading them on a little bit. But
I got a flag bowl out back. You're going to polish the bowl for me, too. There you go. Woohoo!
I mean, I've done that with telemarketers. You have some fun and lead them on for a while and... Why not do the same thing with a door-to-door salesman that's clearly a scammer?
That's how you get – you wonder why you get all those perverted magazines being sent to your house. It's because of those telemarketers.
I never knew that. That's why. Okay. I was always wondering why I was getting these
I can't tell you the fake name of the magazine I just came up with. But we'll just – needless to say, let's move on. You've got an interview. Who are we talking to today?
Yeah, we got Alan Colin. She is with a group called Student Loan Justice. I've talked to him a couple of times in the past. He's worked in the lending industry before, and he just put together a really interesting study that compared the amount of money that people owe in each state and compared that to a state budget. And in most of these states, the state budget is smaller than the amount of money that people owe in student debts. It's insane, so we'll talk about that and more.
Here it is. Brett Johnson right here on AM 950.
Let's welcome in Alan Colin. She is the founder of Student Loan Justice. Website is studentloanjustice.org. Also the author of The Student Loan Scam and creator of a petition on change.org pushing Congress and the Biden administration to cancel student loans, something that's definitely been in the news. Joining us to talk more about that and also some pretty shocking numbers in terms of student debt at the state level. Alan, how are you doing today?
Good to be with you, Brett.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we dive into some of these numbers that you looked at least at the state level, I do want to go to some news that just broke today. This is being reported out of Rolling Stone that the Biden administration is announcing that they are going to rescind a Trump administration rule that only gave partial relief to borrowers who were defrauded by for-profit institutions. Decision could affect about 72,000 borrowers who received less than complete relief under the Trump-era formula and will grant them a combined $1 billion in canceled loans. So I want your reaction to this, Alan, because on the surface, yeah, this certainly seems like a good thing, but as you and I chatted about off air, this really isn't even a drop in the bucket compared to the rest of the student loans we still have outstanding right now.
Oh, that's right, Brett. You know, first of all, these are loans that, by all rights, should have been canceled during the Obama years, so over 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. This is longstanding rules which allow debt to be discharged where the institution lied, committed fraud against their students. So these loans should have gone away a long time ago. And this announcement yesterday is frankly underwhelming to the extreme. you know, this is $1 billion in canceled debt that they are promising. And by the way, it hasn't happened yet, and I will believe it when I see it. But $1 billion is almost nothing compared to the $1,566 billion that the nation owes in federal student debt alone. In fact, the Department of Education, who owns 87% of all student loan debt in the country, they make $1 billion in interest alone in less than 4 days. So, you know, while I'm potentially happy for the 75,000 borrowers who are seeing a $13,000 on average discharge, this is not even a pinprick.
What was that number again? You said they make $1 billion. You said over 4 days?
They make $1 billion in interest on the federal loan portfolio in less than 4 days, a little over 3 days. Yeah, to put that in perspective, you know, this is almost nothing. This is, quite frankly, to someone like me who's been fighting student loan injustice for 16 years now, it's kind of insulting. And, you know, this is a very long, drawn out saga. You know, we've seen glowing headlines like this around this issue for the past 7 or 8 years. We've seen many court victories. We've even had a federal judge threatening Secretary of Education under Trump, Betsy DeVos, with jail time if they did not cancel loans. And, you know, the lesson here, Brett, is that the Department of Education has no desire or intentions of canceling any student loans. It is just against their institutional DNA. You know, I could go on for a while now. We now know, it came out last week, that of the millions of people who signed up for various income-driven repayment plans, 32 people actually ended up qualifying for loan cancellation. 32 people out of several million attempts. So the Department of Education is unfortunately just not a good actor in this game. They are really the largest predatory lender in the country by far.
So what powers does the Office of the Presidency have to cancel student loan debt? Is this something that the Biden administration could do on their own, or is this something that requires congressional approval?
Great question. The president has, and the Secretary of Education have, full, very broad leeway to cancel any and all federal student loans, federally owned student loans, I should say, with nothing more than an order from the secretary under advisement by the president. So the Higher Education Act and the language actually goes back to the late 50s, believe it or not. Congress, decades ago, gave the secretary very broad authority to waive, compromise, release their interest in federally owned student loans. So this could be done tomorrow. President Biden could cancel these loans without congressional approval. Most importantly, without congressional appropriation. In other words, no money would have to be, quote unquote, paid. No money would have to be drawn from Treasury. And incidentally, this would add zero to the national debt. So in terms of fiscal stimulus, there's really no easier, cheaper, and I would say more appropriate way to stimulate the economy.
We're speaking with Alan Kolinge of the group Student Loan Justice. And Alan, one of the things you recently studied was taking a look at the relationship between the amount of money the citizens of one state owes and comparing it to that state's budget. And unbelievably, you found that 18 states have citizens that owe more money than their entire state budget. That is an absolutely shocking number. And I have to imagine you were pretty surprised, too, when you ran these numbers.
Frankly, I was stunned. I sort of had an idea that some of the states were getting close to exceeding their total state budgets. And this is the big state budget, by the way. This is federal and state spending combined. I knew a few states were getting close, but I had no idea how bad it had gotten. So I looked at very recent Department of Education data, and it turns out that some states owe tens of billions of dollars more than their total state budgets in student loan debt. It turns out that Georgia, for whatever reason, turns out to be the worst. So the state of Georgia, their total state budget is $48 billion. Outstanding student loan debt of the citizens of Georgia is around $81 billion. So, and quite frankly, I really don't think, Brett, that many or maybe even any of the governors of these states are aware of this fact. You know, they know about the state budgets, but they probably just don't look at federal student loan debt very carefully. And so this is very big news, and we are trying to spread the words, not only in those states that I mentioned, and people can see the press release for themselves at studentloanjustice.org, but around the country. You know, this is obscene, unacceptable. And quite frankly, this lending system has gone over the cliff. It's become a national threat at this point.
And by the way, here in the state of Minnesota, we have a state budget of about $38 billion, while our citizens owe about $32 billion in student loan debt. So unfortunately, we are getting close to being at that point where our citizens owe more in student debt than our entire state budget. So Alan, another thing I noticed looking at these rankings is that the majority of the states that have their citizens owing more in student debt than their entire state budget are Republican or red-leaning states. Do we have any idea why this is occurring? Are there any specific policies being put in place in these red states?
No, I don't have a good explanation for why 13 of the 19 states that owe more than their total state budgets in student loan debt, why they lean to the right. I don't know. You look at the top of the list and you see states like Florida and Texas and South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, Indiana, Tennessee, Alabama, Maryland, South Dakota, etc. It's a really good question. You know, some of these states tend to have lower per capita state budgets. But, you know, when you look at a state like Georgia where, you know, they owe 169% of their total state budget, you really have to wonder what in the heck is going on here and why did the governors of all those states not spot this many years ago and act? You know, this is a lot of money that's being taken out of these state economies, and the fact that it appears to be hurting the red states far, far worse than average, it should be very concerning for legislators and governors of those states.
I know we talked a little bit about what could be done at the federal level, at least from the Biden administration and an executive order, but what about at state legislative level, or as you said, at the gubernatorial level? What exactly could they do?
Well, not a lot. You know, we have federal supremacy, so they don't have any real power to have direct influence over the problem. You know, what the governors could do, which would be extraordinarily strong, is simply collectively, hopefully, call on the president to cancel these loans. You know, I guess in the worst case scenario, state legislatures could do some fairly radical things and, you know, bar student loan collection companies and other companies from operating in their states, you know, maybe offer some sort of safe harbor legislation, that sort of thing. But you know, Brett, I think if many, if not most of the governors of the country in a single voice stood up and said, Mr. President, cancel these loans, I think it would probably happen, you know, particularly if some conservative governors would stand up and stop fighting for Washington, D.C. and the student loan swamp, as I call it, and start fighting for their own citizens. I think that message would be strong enough to win the day.
And the problem is only going to get much, much worse as we head into the future, because as you wrote, the class of 2004 is already defaulting on their loans 40% of the time, but they were only borrowing one-third of what's being borrowed today. And that is a scary number to think about in terms of what kind of debt numbers we could be looking at in 10, 20, or 30 years from now.
Yeah, Brett, you know, by all rational metrics and measures, this lending system is a catastrophic, and I mean catastrophic failure. You know, even before the pandemic, the guy who literally ran the federal lending system after he stepped down before the pandemic, Wayne Johnson is his name, he told me that 80% of all federal student loan borrowers were never going to be able to repay their loans, even before the pandemic. So, you know, I think we're probably looking at a default rate among all current borrowers of something like 75, 80, 85%. And, you know, by way of comparison, the default rate for subprime home mortgages, which was our most recent failed lending system, the default rate for those loans was only 18%. So we are well over probably four times higher than that. So I don't know what other evidence you need to see to say, yeah, this lending system is, it's done. It's toast.
Another thing that I think is important to point out when we're talking about student loan debt is that it's not just people in their 20s or 30s that are racking up these huge amounts of student debt. In fact, there are a lot of older people who still also owe quite a bit of money.
You know, Brett, believe it or not, and this is a piece of research that we discovered in December, it turns out the highest balance borrowers in this country are over 50 years old. And more than that, there are more people in the country over the age of 50 who have student loans than there are people under the age of 25, which is just astonishing. You know, the way people think about student loans is, okay, yeah, you get your loans in your 20s, you pay them off in your 30s. If you're in your 40s, you still have student loans, that's probably pretty rare. And, you know, it's almost unheard of that people in their 50s would have any student loan debt. That's the common misconception, but it turns out that, in fact, the opposite of that is true. And again, you know, that's just one more piece of evidence that shows very clearly that this lending system is just done. It's vanishing into a mist of illegitimacy. I really think this pandemic is and should be the nail in the coffin of this thing. You know, as a country, we've got to rethink how to fund the colleges in this country. This lending system was maybe a good idea back in the 60s, but the way they turned the lending system into a predatory lending instrument, removing bankruptcy protections that the founders called for in the Constitution, removing statutes of limitations, putting in place a mafia-like collection regime. They really weaponized these loans, and at this point, there is simply no saving it. The easiest, most efficient way to move forward is to be done with these loans, and not partial. This lending system can't be allowed to continue. All the loans must be canceled. And whatever happens in Washington, Brett, you know, nobody is paying on their student loans right now during the pandemic. Even before the pandemic, very few people were, less than half. And whenever they try to lift this repayment suspension, you know, the reality is that very few people will resume making payments. Student loans essentially have become one huge, very painful national joke at this point.
So what can people do to get involved with your organization, Student Loan Justice? And also, what can people do in terms of contacting their elected officials to try to get student debt relief?
Absolutely. Number one, this is not a thing that Congress can do, really. This comes down to President Biden. We have to push President Biden to cancel these loans. He has already signaled some resistance to that. He's kind of dragging his feet. I would urge everybody there, particularly people that live in or know people who live in the 19 states that are mentioned in our report, get with the governors. You know, the governors cannot allow this to happen on their watch. So we need to put pressure on the president. We need to put pressure on the governors. One thing we do need Congress for is returning bankruptcy protections to all student loans. So there are quite a few student loans out there that the president cannot cancel by executive order. We absolutely must get constitutional bankruptcy protections returned to those. So if people want to call their congressperson, don't waste your time talking about loan cancellation. Push your members of Congress, particularly your senators, particularly your Republican senators, to return bankruptcy protections to all student loans. That really should have happened decades ago. And it would have saved us a lot of the pain and everything that we're seeing now here today.
That's Alan Colin. He is the founder of Student Loan Justice. That website is studentloanjustice.org. And they also have a petition over at change.org.
AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Thanks very much to Brett for that interview. We do appreciate it. One quick thing that you and I, Patrick, were talking about the NCAA tournaments. I don't know if you've seen these viral videos that are starting to show up in viral social media posts, but the first one I saw was from Oregon Ducks player Sedona Prince, who made a video which basically showed the difference between the men's facilities, the weight rooms, practice courts, and meeting areas versus what the NCAA had set up for the women. And it's an embarrassment that the difference that they have set up here. I mean, it is truly an embarrassing thing. Have you seen any of those posts yet?
I actually just saw one a little bit ago. I did not get the chance to read it yet. I am disappointed, but at the same time, wholly unsurprised.
I'm completely unsurprised, too. I mean, just the NCAA has got a real big problem. Is that you talk about Title IX, and I mean, how in the world do you just, okay, get two sets of the stuff, set the stuff up? And they don't. And the reality is that, you know, equality meets equality. So if you're going to have this stuff, it's not like the other basketball team doesn't do the same exact things. I mean, the Sedona Prince post is, to a point, tragic because, you know, it just shows like one little weight bell, you know, dumbbell weight thing and hardly a practice court. And it's an embarrassment. The NCAA should be ashamed of themselves, especially considering there's a lot of people that are out there marketing this NCAA women's tournament just as much as the men's tournament. So, you know, there is no excuse. There is absolutely zero excuse for two different standards when it comes to the facilities that the men's team and the women's team have. All right? There just is. I mean, that's just reality. 952-946-6205. Quick segment here. Let's get back on track. When we do a come on back, Laura Lee Campos is going to join us. We'll talk about parenting with her and, of course, you know, revisit that weird story that I had to share about that. We'll come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Finding the right lawyer is incredibly stressful.
AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Now, we are going to go back and revisit kind of an odd story that happened earlier this year. What had happened was that my wife, who is in the corporate world, she was at a corporate seminar with this speaker authority on parenting, Laura Lee Campos. And I wasn't part of this. I had not ever met Laura Lee Campos. But Laura Lee Campos went on to describe a story I had that was my story of an incident that happened at a baseball field back in 2012 that I'd forgotten I'd written in MinnPost about. But we talked about on the air back then, you know, back in the old 6 o'clock show back then. And she was, it was part of her parenting seminar that, you know, you gotta teach kids correctly. And so I put it upon myself considering, and I said, asked my wife, I said, did you tell her about the story? Nope. So I went and tracked down Laura Lee Campos, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the show Laura Lee Campos, author, speaker. She's also an expert in parenting, mother of five. You can find her information at 10minuteparent.com, or you can also listen to the Let's Talk About Life Conversation Starters. Laura Lee, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Hi, I'm excited to be here, and every time you start to talk about that story, it's just like I can't believe what a small world it is.
Sometimes it really is, and it's amazing. And by the way, thank you. That's the fact that, I mean, when you write something like that and you put it out there, you don't know if people are listening, but for you, obviously, it resonated with you because you and I think, agree. I've looked at a lot of your parenting stuff, and I think you and I agree on a lot of things that... Mm-hmm. In caring, nurturing for children, of course, but it's this, we have to remember we're the parents and we're the adults, and that kids cannot become a parent unless you treat, you know, kind of, you know, establish those rules and those roles. And, you know, you talk a lot in with your parenting style about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of parents out there that, you know, everyone gets a trophy, you know, never make your kid can never feel bad. Your kid can never, you know, can never know what it's like to lose or to have to deal with loss and that sort of thing. And the reality is that that's not a great way necessarily to raise kids.
No, I mean, and I think the story resonated with me because I was going through this. I was creating this ebook at the time called Dizzy Busy Dozen, which is 12 things parents should stop doing. And one of those 12 was stepping in to protect your children, especially when they've done something wrong. And the child in the story, he had behaved very badly, especially insulting an adult with his language. And yet you were the one apologizing all afternoon. It was wrong, and it was teaching the absolute worst message to that child. And it's not the parents' fault. I mean, everybody sort of jumped on this bandwagon of the self-esteem movement that started decades ago. And after they looked back at the whole thing, they realized that this book was written, I think, by Nathaniel Brandon in 1960. And the people who even supported it at the time started questioning it. And all these studies and all these articles, thousands and thousands of articles about this self-esteem thing, they realized was based on nothing scientific. So everyone has sort of been brainwashed and bamboozled into thinking that it's, you know, it's a parent's job to give their children self-esteem and make their children happy and create success for them. And it's almost as if we've been convinced that if we give them enough praise, enough A's, and enough trophies, they'll think like winners. Mm-hmm. But anybody who's successful in life or studies successful people knows that that's not how life works. So it's like common sense has sort of gone out the window.
To a point, and, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yes, because I think most people know instinctively that doesn't make sense, and yet they're doing all these things because the experts, the teachers, the therapists, the counselors, the parenting experts have all been telling them this is what they need to do for their child's success. And it's the absolute opposite of really what they need to be doing, and now everybody's sort of seeing the result of that sort of disastrous self-esteem movement. And I think one of the saddest things that I read about was in a book written by a Stanford dean of admissions. She had been there 12 years and saw over a 12-year period this major shift in children's, in the students' attitudes about life in terms of being more anxious, more depressed, less able to function, more scared, unable to make decisions, even make choices. And then they saw these parents who were just becoming more and more intrusive and more overprotective and making every decision for their kids. I mean, what classes they took, what activities they were going to be. I mean, I'm talking college.
Yeah.
There are still parents who are actually writing their kids essays in college still, you know, and,
wow.
and trying to negotiate with, I mean, they're trying to negotiate with their kids' you know, potential bosses for interviews and even their benefits. There was a woman who called her daughter's boss after she had started a job and asked, "Oh, could you please plan a birthday party for my daughter?" And he said, "We don't do that here, ma'am. This is Wall Street." I mean, it's I'm not kidding. It's sort of out of control. But anyway, this dean of students at, dean of admissions at Stanford wrote this book called How to Raise an Adult, which is much along the line of what we've been talking about. And I think the thing she cited in there that was the most disturbing for me, which I always include in any of my presentations, is they did the American College Health Association did a survey of 100,000 students. Now, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
100,000 students in 153 different universities and college campuses across the country, asking them, well, how did they feel emotionally over the last 12 months? And the results are very sad. I mean, 84% felt overwhelmed with what they had to do. 60% felt very sad, not just sad, but very sad. 57% felt very lonely. 51% felt extremely anxious. At least this is how they're feeling, how they're seeing it. 46% felt hopeless, and 31% felt so depressed they could not function.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the best and the brightest of our children. And well, they're miserable.
Well, and I want one of the things I want to say is, and folks, you know, it's what she's saying, and I 100% agree with her. It's not about, of course, you love your kids, you take care of your kids. If your kids want to talk, you talk with your kids. That's not the deal here. But I come at it from a different angle. How about this one? I look at the fact when I was a kid, I was in second grade. In second grade at Wickford Elementary School in Rhode Island. I remember the teacher looking at me and saying, you know, in this delightful, you know, witch voice, if you don't turn your work, you are going to fail and repeat the grade. And it scared the living daylights out of you. And, you know, and back when in the 70s, if you failed a class, even in elementary school, you repeated. And one of the things that I have disagreed with the standard of teaching is that we don't hold necessarily kids to certain levels, and that there are some places where kids can do only 10% of the work, but they'll get moved on because they don't want to fail them because they're worried about their feelings. And the reality is, I think the end result is, yeah, sure, some kids, they graduate college and they have trouble and they can't find a job and they have to move back home. But I think one of the reasons why you have almost an epidemic of students, you know, college kids, college graduates moving back with their parents is because they've just never had to deal with challenges in the real world.
In life.
Exactly. Yes. And so I think...
That's exactly what we're talking about. These kids are not prepared for life.
Yeah.
They've been shielded and protected. They don't even call it helicopter parenting anymore. They call it snowplow parenting. Parents are getting in front of their children and basically clearing the path so that they don't feel any form of frustration, disappointment, humiliation, rejection, sadness, the normal things in life that make you think about what you just did and do differently.
You're a human being.
They're robbing their children of the opportunities to learn how to deal with life. And so instead of helping their children, which is what they think they're doing, they're actually handicapping them. And I mean, and the sad thing is that, you know, they're trying so hard. And so I really feel bad for parents because it's not their fault. They've been sort of bamboozled into this situation by everyone around them, letting them think that this is, you know, what they need to do. And if you think for a minute about what they're actually communicating when they step in to rescue, coddle, fix, protect, whatever, they're saying, oh, I don't believe you're capable of success without my help. I think you're too fragile to handle disappointment. I think you're not smart enough, strong enough, or good enough to find solutions, you know, settle arguments or fix mistakes on your own. You know, they don't have to be responsible for their choices or behavior, you know, or that failure is such an awful thing. We have to avoid it at all costs, when failure is what teaches you how to get up again and figure it out.
That you can have you can have your worst day ever and you still will be able to function. And that doesn't mean it means it's good. We'll be there to support you. We're there to help you. But you can have a bad day. That's how you have to learn. I wholeheartedly agree. I wanted to touch with you, though, if we could, because we are in a different time than we've ever been in before, at least in our generation. Yes. This pandemic has been very difficult. And, you know, you've gotten an interesting dynamic in a lot of families where there's been a lot more, you know, personal relationships on one side of it. I think it's really good that people are, you know, getting to know their kids. Mm-hmm. On the other side is we're coming out of it. Hopefully we're coming out of it at this point.
Right.
We're looking to get back. What are some thoughts and some concerns that you are looking as a parenting expert that parents should be aware of as we come into this new, hopefully post-pandemic era?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to be a transition and it's not over yet and things aren't going to be normal that quickly, even though we may be moving back into schools and things like that. I think, I mean, of course, the pandemic goes way beyond this just fear of being sick and losing someone. It's affected us by losing jobs, worrying about money, being separated from people, lack of social activities, you know, working from home, trying to take care of your children. I mean, so many changes that we've had to adapt to. And we have to adapt if we want to maintain our sanity and happiness. But what I think is tough times, like what we're experiencing right now, are actually the best opportunities to talk to our children about what's really important and to teach them the mindsets that will lead to a successful future. And when it comes to happiness and success, decades of research have shown us that nothing matters more than how we look at life, how we think about life, and how we react to life. Nothing will have as big an impact on your children's future, of course, than how they think about life. And I'm talking not where they go to college, not their GPA, not how many extracurricular activities that they had, or not even how intelligent they are. And scientists have been proving this over and over again for decades. So the mindsets are the most important thing we can talk to our children about and teach them. And these are great opportunities right now, difficult times, to talk about being resilient, being flexible, being able to adapt, being empathetic about, you know, what others are going through, being positive and trying to look for the good in people or situations, taking responsibility to help where we can, being kind to those around us, and being grateful for what we do have. All of those mindsets are what science is saying are the most important things that help people succeed. And it's what corporate America is now looking for when they're hiring new young candidates. They're looking for those emotional skills, because they realize that they're better indicators of success than where you went to college.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is all the craziness that parents have been working towards to try to get their kids into the best top college is not necessarily what's going to help them be successful in life. And the most important thing is if they just talk to their kids 10 minutes a day about the important things,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's hard. Well, what do I talk about and this and that? And that's one of the things that we've done at 10 Minute Parent is developed a set of digital conversation starters that are all designed around one mindset to focus on for an entire month. So as a family, every time you sit down to dinner or sitting in the carpool or getting hamburgers, or it doesn't matter when, but whenever you have a time to be together, even for 10 minutes, talk about what's important, you know. And so there are these conversation starters that just kind of keep talking about that one topic all month to the point where at the end of the month, nobody's going to forget that message. And
yep.
how important it is. And so it's a great way to, with just a little bit of time, help your kids learn what they really need to learn to be able to manage the challenges and difficulties and the ups and downs of life. And that's what I think that this COVID situation helps us think about, how important that is, you know. And,
yeah.
and probably a lot of parents have had a tendency to cater to their children even more, like they feel bad for them because they can't be with their friends. They feel bad for them,
yeah.
you know, and they'll communicate that,
yeah.
you know, oh, I'll give them the iPad for longer, or I'll do this or that, instead of saying, well, you know, this is tough. We're all having a tough time, but we'll be okay. And this is what we'll do. And if that doesn't work, we'll do this. But I mean, help them work through what it's like to adapt and be resilient and figure out how to make the best of something.
I want to send people to your website here. We're running out of time here, but I want to go with
okay.
www.10minuteparent, 10, the number 10, 10, minuteparent.com. Mm-hmm. And then the Let's Talk
yes.
About Life conversation starters, they're there on the website on Let's Talk.
Yes.
Lorelei, I'm going to basically make sure I link to everything here because I think you're spot
okay.
on. And by all means, I want you to come back at some point. We can talk even more if that's possible.
I'd love to. There's tons of different things along this line that we can delve into, and I'd be happy to do that. So thank you so much for bringing me on. I'm always happy to share with parents because it's a tough thing to do. It's the hardest job there is.
Indeed. Lorelei Campos, once again, 10minuteparents.com, 10minuteparent.com, 10minuteparent.com. and the Let's Talk About Life Conversation Starters. I'll link to all this a little bit later on, and we'll spotlight Laura Lee this today as well, so you can listen to that interview again. We'll take a break. Come on back. I got to do some dancing when I do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. We got one. Oh, we got one. What I'm referring to is this. A 31-year-old Moorhead, Minnesota's man has been arrested Friday on charges related to criminal acts at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Minnesota had not had anyone arrested for the January 6th attack, but this guy, he put a lot of evidence out there. What's this guy's name again? Stotts. Oh, Jordan K. Stotts. Rot in jail, Jordan. According to the criminal complaint, a former classmate of Stotts tipped off the FBI after noticing several social media posts indicating he was at the Capitol for the riot. One post under Stotts' name described the story of the siege. It all started by scaling a wall as we broke into the U.S. Capitol to strike fear into the sold-out Congress. We were tear-gassed and two people were shot. We were peaceful. Okay, wait a minute here. You just said you scaled a wall and broke in, but then you said you were peaceful. Okay. But the police were not. Police were aggressive and on the wrong side. Yeah, you killed one and injured about 100 more. Of course, now he's like, well, there was a door that was open. I went through there. Rot in jail, you punk. Rot in jail, you traitorous bastard. Yes, get him. Get them all. It's like Pokemon. We got to catch them all. All right. It's been a while since I picked BTS. I don't think I've ever picked BTS. A little Dynamite. Oh, yeah. I'm dancing out to this. You can watch that on the live streams. Have a great weekend. We're back on a Monday. Until then, see ya. Cause I'm aiming stars tonight. So watch me bring the fire, set the night light. Shoes on, get up in the morning, cup of milk, let's rock and roll. Kink out, kick the drum, rolling on like a Rolling Stone. Sing song when I'm walking home, jump up to the top of the LeBron. Ding dong, call me on my phone, nice tea and I'll get my ping pong.